Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is a barbershop style conversation between two brothers. So since we both are follically challenged, neither one of us will be in the chair.
We just be talking mess from the side.
There you go. We're that brother sitting in the row who has an opinion every now and then that he likes to share with the rest of the room. So... Hey, everybody. What up? I'm so glad everybody could join us here on the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It's such a pleasure being back with you in the house, as we like to say. I hope everyone's doing well. Look, you know, the country's opening back up, and there's a lot of ish going on out there that we are going to get into in our conversation today for sure. But the most important thing is, y'all, just be smart. Please don't be stupid. Use your better judgment. Put the damn mask on, okay? Yeah, I know you want to show off the rest of your face. We know what you look like. Just put the mask on. Save people the prospect of catching something from you or you catching something from someone else. To help us in our conversation and to put all of this that's going on around the country in perspective is a gentleman I have had the pleasure of watching on our air at MSNBC, and to be quite honest, I've been impressed with him and excited about what he's doing. And that's from a nonpartisan perspective. I'm talking as a guy who was a county, state, and national chairman who knows what talent looks like, who won a lot of elections with good talent, and know what candidates who bring their A game every moment they step up to the mic looks and sounds like. And that is Jamie Harrison. He's the former chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Elected in 2013, Jamie was the first African-American chair. So he and I hold that in common together. A position that he held until 2017. He's currently running for the United States Senate from South Carolina. I, like Jamie, ran for the United States Senate in 2006 from the state of Maryland. I hope his outcome is a hell of a lot better than mine was in 2006. And what makes his race a national race and one of note and prominence is not just the fact that Jamie is a cool guy, and I think you'll find that out from our conversation, but that Jamie's running against incumbent Senator, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham. For purposes that everyone should know, we reached out to Senator Lindsey Graham and have a standing invitation to the good senator whom I've known for many years to come on to talk about his campaign and to talk about his job as a U.S. Senator in the age of COVID-19. Unfortunately, they did not respond to our request. It was not an invitation for him to come on and do a debate with Jamie, because I don't want that. I want to have a one-on-one with Jamie, just like I would like to have a one-on-one with the good senator in due course if he wants it to happen. But since he ain't here, as we like to say, we're going to have a conversation with Jamie. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's so good to be with you. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, it's nice to have you on, Mr. Chairman. So, you know, I got a little down home punch right now. So I'm saluting you, brother, and wishing you well. So before we get into policy and politics, let's learn a little bit about you. You're running for the United States Senate. You were chairman of the South Carolina Party. Oh, and just by the way, folks, and a lot of folks who know me know this fact, so forgive me for repeating it, but you may not. So you are in my backyard, brother. I spent a significant portion of my life in South Carolina. My mom is from St. Matt, born in St. Matthews, raised in Orangeburg. My family is from Orangeburg.
Wow.
We live.
I had no idea.
Our family home was literally about 3 miles down the road from the community college, which we all know and love there in South Carolina. I spent growing up on a farm in dirt roads. My mother would send me down every summer from about age 8 until literally I went, right through college. So I was in my 20s when I stopped going down to South Carolina every summer. So, that's my home. I love it. I just ordered a bunch of grits from back home. I couldn't find grits here. Dude, I have spent this entire lockdown looking for some damn grits. And finally, a friend of mine said, well, you know, South Carolina has grits. Why don't you go online? And I did.
We got plenty of it. Well, you know, one of the things is that speaking of which, I grew up in Orangeburg, and my grandma and my aunts and cousins, they're still there. And so I get down there every so often, and, there's nothing like some of these old, there's that one grocery store, I don't know if you ever went there, F.L. Metz.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff was more expensive than the other stores, but my grandma always needed to go there so she'd get her sausage and, you know, she said they had the best pork chops, and that was her store that she went to. And so, I went there too because we had no other choice. But she'd go there to get her casings. Now I don't know if you ever had to do this with your grandma, but we used to make our own liver pudding. We just call it pudding.
Pudding, yeah.
And we would make. Sometimes my grandma would want to make her own sausage, so we would go to Metz to get the casings, and then she'd cook up all the meat, and then she'd bake this, put this big thing of rice, because the pudding has rice in it, and then, she has this old metal crank, and she still may have this crank, where you basically put the casings on the crank, and then you stuff it with the meat and the stuff, and you just crank it up, and I used to just sit there and get wash tubs full of sausage and pudding that she used to then give to family members. She would freeze some of it. That was life.
Well, look, dude, while we're having that moment, so one of mine was and my aunt, my great aunt, Lucille, God rest her. Oh, what a wonderful woman. And her husband, we had a little family farm, and they had the chickens, the hogs. There was a damn donkey that didn't mind anybody. And I swear this donkey was a pain in my ass. Oh my God. My uncle would be like, okay, so we're going out in the field and we're taking this thing. And this SOB would stop at the edge of the field, 'cause he knew what was about to happen. He had to work. Right? And he'd just sit there and look at you. And of course my uncle's like, come on, bring him on. I'm like, he ain't coming. And I was not going to get up under a hoof of some damn donkey. So, But we used to, I'll never forget the day I had to prepare my first chicken for dinner.
And, oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, dude. So my uncle.
I know.
You know, right?
So you had to scald in water in order to. Yeah.
No, babe, it was worse than that. I had to go kill the sucker.
Oh, so then it hopped around.
Oh, yes. Yes.
With no head.
Absolutely. Had to cut the head off of this chicken, then throw the body into the yard. And it literally, I know where the phrase running around like a chicken with his head cut off, because that's exactly what happened. The damn thing, I can see it to this day, running around the yard. Then it just drops. And my uncle goes, okay, now let's go pick it. And we had to go pick the feathers off of it, clean it up. And then the scalding hot water, the taking it in the house. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm done at the taking the head off part. So I'm going to go hang out with the donkey.
Well, folks don't understand, you know, living in a rural community, and particularly during that time, it wasn't easy. It wasn't an easy life. I mean, there are a lot of character building activities during by doing that, but you know, I wouldn't give anything for it. I think that experience really grounded me and gave me exposure to, you know, some of the hardships that so many people have to deal with and that they're still dealing with.
Right.
Because, you know, in many parts of rural South Carolina, it's still just like that. You know, things haven't changed.
No, they have not changed. That is part of your backdrop, your story for running for the United States Senate. What is that about? How do you go from being a guy who is sort of navigating the politics and putting the candidates out there to the guy who is the candidate and not just a candidate, but potentially one who will be one of 100, which is a very unique club in our American politics.
Yep.
And as I noted, would be a senator, a black senator from South Carolina, two brothers from South Carolina. What the hell?
Yep.
Lord, folks won't know what to do with themselves. You and Tim Scott.
It's about the New South.
There you go,
the New South.
So what's that journey like for you so far? And how did you get to that point where your service, you think, now warrants becoming a United States senator?
Partly, Mr. Chairman, you know, I believe that you need folks in the Senate who understand the American dream. And there is, you know, not many people I know whose life is epitomizes that than mine. Mm-hmm. I mean, my mom was 16 years old when she had me. She dropped out of high school. We stayed with my grandparents, and, you know, and my grandparents really took care of me for most of my life. They had my grandma had an 8th grade education. She stopped school to pick cotton, and then she worked in the textile industry and did domestic work. And then my grandfather stopped school in 4th grade. He was the eldest of his siblings. He had to stop school. He worked in a dairy, and then he worked construction most of his life until he got diabetes and had to get some amputations, and he stopped work. So, you know, these folks were, you know, simple people in some aspects, but they were rich in terms of their character and their values. They taught me the value. I don't know two people who have worked harder in their lives than my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
They taught me the value of hard work, but they also taught me the value of helping other people. My grandma would often say, she said, you know, Jamie, even though we are the least of these, you still have an obligation to take care of the least of these. And it was one of those things where you came to our house. We didn't have a whole lot, but on that Sunday, the pots were all on the stove.
Mm-hmm.
The oven would be humming. You would come, and if you're hungry, my grandma would fix you a plate. And then when you're leaving, there'd be a plate wrapped up in aluminum foil right there next to the door, so you can take along with you just in case you got hungry later on. And that's just that's the type of people they were, and that's who I am. And part of the reason why I got into this race is because when I was chair, I would go all around South Carolina. And I saw that many of the communities that I visited when I was a young kid with my grandparents hadn't changed or actually got worse from that time. And when you see young kids who no longer have that little glitter in their eye, mm-hmm. that light that I know I had in mind that, you know what, I can do and I can become whatever I want to. When you don't see that light anymore, then you know we have problems. And that's why I decided to get into this race, because, you know, the people in South Carolina didn't change. Our environment didn't change. It's still a beautiful state. It's just that we have crappy leadership these days. And I think Lindsey Graham epitomizes that. This is a guy who is more focused on his own political relevance and political power than he is the fact that, you know, you got 14 counties of our 46 where there are no OBGYNs, or that a third of the state doesn't have Wi-Fi, or that 4 of our rural hospitals have closed. You know, these are real issues that not just Democrats or not just black folks, but all folks in South Carolina are dealing with. And you got to have somebody who's willing to roll up their sleeves and focus more on that than whether or not they have a TV hit time on Fox, you know, every night with Sean Hannity. I mean, and that's problematic.
You mentioned New South, and I am more than familiar with what that looks like and what that means. Witnessed, as I mentioned, as we were having fun in the beginning, talking about growing up effectively there in the South. My mother wanted me to have that exposure of her life growing up there, to the family there. And you touched on so many things in your comments there about the condition in yeah. South Carolina, the hospitals that are closed, the communities without Wi-Fi, the lack of a level playing field between the haves and the have-nots, if you will. In so many ways, that represents the old South. That's a condition that yes. everyone's okay with. All right.
Yep.
And as long as some are getting by, then that's okay. You're talking about a new South paradigm in which that's not okay.
That's exactly
and that everyone has an equal opportunity at the American dream as they define it. How do you, as a United States senator, see your role playing out in this new South paradigm, and what does that mean to you in terms of your leadership?
Yeah, well, one of them is I want to be the rural senator in the United States Senate who understands the importance of investing in our rural communities, because for more than a generation they've been ignored. The plight and the issues that farmers are dealing with on a day-to-day basis, nobody's, you know, outside of maybe Tester and one or two others, nobody's really talking about or fighting about those particular issues. And you know, in this country there's the myth of when you say rural, people automatically think you mean white, right? But that's not what you, if you lived in a rural community, you understand that rural community look is just as diverse as urban communities
right.
are. But they have a certain set of hardships that they have to deal with that you don't have to deal with in urban settings. And you take this coronavirus situation and you see the huge divide between urban and rural. Now, South Carolina, we have cities, but you know, even our cities compared to a New York or Atlanta are still somewhat rural as it relates to those cities,
sure.
because they're much smaller. And so one of the things that we are going to do on this campaign and very soon is roll out an agenda about how we rebuild and revitalize rural communities. You know, right now we got 40 communities in South Carolina, all rural, where the lead level is higher than the federal standards. So, you know, a similar situation that's going on in Flint, but you find it all around rural South Carolina. And I'm sure you can go to Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, and you probably see the same types of situations there as well.
Well, that's a good opportunity for us to take a quick break so our sponsors can have a little fun with our listeners. And when we come back, I want to talk to you, Jamie, a little bit more about coronavirus and its impact on all of this and how that's affected the campaign. And we'll have a lot more with Jamie Harrison, candidate for the United States Senate from South Carolina, right after this.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
All right, so we're back in convo with the wannabe senator, Jamie Harrison. We ended the last part of our conversation talking about the impact on rural communities and what that looks like, the emergence of a new South and what that may very well be. How has this COVID-19 epidemic or pandemic affected your bid as a U.S. senator? You're not doing the in-person kind of conversations that you would normally do. You're not glad-handing around the state. You're not doing the donor fundraisers in person where you're looking someone in the eye and taking the check, which is always a lot of fun. but how are you dealing with that relative to your opponent, Senator Graham, who has the benefit of incumbency, quite honestly, and by virtue of name identification, probably bankroll, and being the incumbent, at least the conventional thinking is he doesn't have to work as hard. I disagree with that in this cycle for reasons we can get into. But how are you adjusting and addressing some of that with COVID-19 overhanging everything?
Yeah, well, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic has really impacted our communities very hard here in South Carolina. And, you know, many of the issues that I've been talking about are now they're being amplified because of the situation. Again, the lack of broadband access across the state in a time when you need to work from home and educate your kids from home, it creates a lot of problems. The fact that we have folks here who don't have health care, that creates problems because, Lindsay and some of the folks, the powers that be, refuse to expand Medicaid here in South Carolina. And so what we are trying to do is our very best, because I believe in showing and not telling. And so, you know, you find on campaigns all the time, politicians like to tell people what they're going to do and how they're going to do it and when they're going to do it. Well, I feel like it's much more powerful for me to demonstrate through my actions and not just through my words. And so we launched a program well before the coronavirus hit called Harrison Helps, which is out in the community, partnering with community organizations and doing something novel in politics these days. We're helping people. So just over the past few months, we probably helped over, between 10 and 15,000 families with hygiene kits, with food for first responders, the people on the front lines of the coronavirus. And prior to that, we've been doing school supplies drives, working with community organizations like Habitat for Humanity and ABLE and the Ronald McDonald House, because it's really important for me to be in these communities so that folks understand that this is a part of who I am. These are the values that I hold dear. And it's not just something a few months before an election, but it's how I have lived my life, all of my 44 years. And that's really important. So we're still, we're utilizing technology and we're doing town halls. And we're trying to target our town halls so that they're specific to the things that people are concerned about. So, for instance, just recently we had one on mental and spiritual health in this time of the coronavirus, because right now those things are being tested like nothing. We also had a town hall about what happens. We're a few weeks from hurricane season. South Carolina is one of those states that is in Hurricane Alley. What happens when you have the coronavirus and a hurricane is approaching? How do you prepare for that? What do our cities and towns, how should they be prepared for? So it's those type of things that we're trying to do right now. And listen, I don't spend too much time thinking about Lindsay and what he's doing. Last quarter, I don't know if you know this, Mr. Chairman, but we outraised Lindsey Graham.
Really?
So he raised $5.6 million, which was a new state record for a quarter. Well, we outraised them. We raised $7.35 million last quarter.
So you set the record.
So we set the record.
Just so we're clear here with how records are set.
Yes. We set the record. And we've been getting huge endorsements. Dick Wilkerson, who was the chairman and president of Michelin North America, probably the largest company here in South Carolina. He was also co-chair of Lindsey Graham's finance committee when he ran for president. Well,
I remember him from my days at the RNC. Yeah.
So two weeks ago, Dick Wilkerson came out and said, you know what? I'm supporting Jamie Harrison because I believe he's the future of South Carolina. And he said this, which is quite interesting, because another article came out today about previous Graham donors who are now supporting me. But in his statement, he said, when I look at Lindsey Graham and I look at the fact that he did not stand up and defend the honor of John McCain against the attacks from the president, I said to myself, if he won't stand up for his best friend, then what will he do for me?
Well, and can that, okay. See, you opened up the door. Now you're going to make me go inside and play. All right. So that has been, I've known Lindsay a long time, have worked with him on the Hill, worked with him outside the Hill, considered him a buddy and still do. We last saw each other on a plane flight before coronavirus hit and, you know, exchanged good pleasantries and all of that. But that key point that you just made is the one that I think rubs most people the rawest, is that it's not like we were unaware of your relationship with John McCain. It's not like we were not privy to those intimate, and I mean that in a very nice way, those intimate moments between the two of them where they would talk about each other. And then to have, when his McCain's family and his service and his leadership were questioned by a man who has not the authority nor the gravitas to tie John McCain's shoes, to trash him the way he did, without a response, to me, as a fellow Republican, as a fellow conservative, but most importantly, as an American, I was like, damn, bro, seriously? That's your boy. That's your ride or die. That's the guy that, you know, when it starts going on, you know, as they say, you find the Vaseline, put it on, and you go do your thing, right?
You take the earrings off,
right? You're gonna let him talk smack about your brother? Come on. So that, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And probably after hearing this portion, Lindsay will never come on my podcast, but that's okay. But you know, but that's a real truth. And so with that, again, these narratives, and we know, I can tell you, I've been in the room when these things happen. All of that's very good, Jamie, that to have a former, you know, finance chairman on donors and political people around your opponent gravitate to you. How do you translate that into votes? Because at the end of the day, this ain't about the fundraiser saying, yeah, I like Jamie because he's the future of South Carolina. It's about how that translates into votes, because at election day, as you know, that's the only thing that matters. So what does that do? How is the black vote, which we saw change the fortunes of Joe Biden? And I always said from the very beginning, I thought Joe would be the nominee of the Democratic Party, should be the nominee of the Democratic Party, and that black folks would be the ones who ultimately would make him the nominee of the Democratic Party. Now, folks, that doesn't mean he has to pick a black woman to be his vice president, but that's another show, and I'm not going to put Jamie in that spot.
No, I don't want to go in there.
Yeah, no, that's not your conversation. You're running for U.S. Senate, not for the presidency. But the reality is, how do you turn all of that into votes?
Yeah, well, part of it is the frame by which we talk about this race and talk about the issues that people are dealing with here in South Carolina. You know, the thing that I understand about voters is that, and this is something where I think Democrats sometimes get off the rails. You know, a lot of times Democrats love to get involved in the policy and the nuance of policies and having that, you know, becoming wonks. But we got to understand that the average voter, the man and the woman that's working one and a half, two jobs, that are trying to keep it in the middle of the road, feed their families, clothe their kids,
right,
and still be able to do work. Those folks don't get the opportunity to sit on TV, sit and watch us pontificate on TV or read all these newspaper articles or read all of the policy descriptions. And many times those people make up their minds about who they're going to support and vote for in the last week or two of the campaign. And when you think about where they make that decision, it's not always a head decision, but it's more of a heart and a gut decision. And so, therefore, it's important for us as a Democratic candidate, or for me, to make sure that I'm messaging to the heart and to the gut as well. And so those are where values live, and not just where, you know, sort of the policy interests. Those are where values live. And so as I tell people about this campaign, it is not about Democrats versus Republicans or progressives versus conservatives. It's about what's right versus wrong. And the question is, of the candidates, who's on the side of right more often than on the side of wrong? And I think if you take the tape on that, I will be on the side of right, because I want to fight for those rural hospitals that are closing. I want to make sure that, you know, pregnant moms have OBGYNs that they can go to, that kids have broadband within their schools and within their community so that they can connect, that we're taking care of our farmers and that we're taking care of the environment as well. And Lindsey's just been on the wrong side of those issues because he's more been concerned about his political power and interest in what's in the best interest of the folks of South Carolina. And so as I go around the state, as I deliver that message, prior to Corona, we were going into Republican areas. Mr. Chairman, I tell you, I went to one county, Lancaster County. This county went 61-35 for Donald Trump. I went to a senior community. We had about 30 RSVPs. So I thought, oh, we'll have a nice little crowd. I walk into the door. There were 250 people sitting there in the room. And I was shocked. And the majority of them were older white voters.
Really?
Right?
Interesting.
I'll send you a picture so that you can see this. I mean, I almost fell out. I was like, am I in the right space?
Right, right.
And so they turned around, because I came in through the back door. They turned around and they looked at me and they stood up and they started clapping and they started chanting, send Lindsey home, send Lindsey home. And I almost had my own little minor heart attack right there in that room. But, you know, and a number of them came up to me afterwards, and one woman said, you know, I voted for Lindsey Graham more than I can remember. She said, but I didn't like the fact that he didn't stand up for McCain, and I want somebody who's going to fight for us. And that's the testament of this race is going to end up not being won or lost based on this policy or this bill or whatever, but based on the character and the values of the persons, of the people that they are making the choice between. And I used to respect Lindsey Graham as well. I used to work with his office. And I thought that, you know, when McCain was alive, I thought in the end of the day, Lindsey Graham would do what was in the best interest of the nation and the state of South Carolina. I don't feel that way anymore. And the one thing that we know in politics, when you lose the trust of people, that's much more devastating than anything else that can happen in politics, because people feel like they believed in you and you did something to lose that trust. And it's hard to get that trust back.
So will he
and
debate?
That's why in the state, I think we're going to win.
So will he debate you?
I don't know. But, you know, I saw Chuck Todd recently. He's like, that's a debate that I would love to moderate. We'll see. We'll see whether or not Lindsey will. I mean, if we continue to raise the money that we're raising and to get these endorsements, it's going to be hard for him to tell the people of South Carolina that he's not willing to debate. Because in the end, this is not his seat. This seat is owned by the people of South Carolina, not by Lindsey Graham. He's just sitting in it. And so, you know, if it's just me with a blow-up doll of Lindsey or a cutout, then
see, okay.
we'll have it.
You created a visual I didn't need. All right, so what would it mean to have two black senators from the state of South Carolina?
It would be huge and historic. And particularly, I want you to think about the seat that I'm running for. Lindsey currently occupies it, but before Lindsey Graham, it was Strom Thurmond. And before it was Strom Thurmond, it was a man by the name of Ben Pitchfork Tillman. And I don't know if you've ever heard of that name.
I have.
Yeah. For your listeners, Ben Tillman was not only a senator, but he was also governor of South Carolina. He changed the constitution of the state of South Carolina because he never wanted a black person to become the governor. And so therefore, we have one of the weakest governorships in the country because of the measures that he took, because he wanted a black governor to be powerless. But this is also a man who, when he was in the Senate, would go on the floor and talk about with joy the lynching of black folks. And so this would be a historic moment for us. And it would be turning the page to and starting a new chapter on South Carolina and who we are, where we're going. You know, I have a very cordial relationship with Tim Scott. He would become the senior senator from South Carolina.
What would that mean? What would that look like? What would that relationship look like? Because you arguably would hold views and positions on issues relevant to black folks that may be different from the other black senator. How does that narrative play itself out in the black community with black folks looking on with two senators debating blackness and issues and all of that?
Yeah. Well, I hope there's some synergy because Tim and I grew up in a very similar fashion. Single mom in poor community. He was in North Charleston. I was in Orangeburg. So, you know, I would hope that would create some space for us to really do some amazing things and bringing some bipartisan support and doing some things that could have a tremendous impact on the black community and South Carolina as a whole. But at the same time, we're going to push on each other on certain things. Tim is right now with Lindsay on the, you know, opposing the extension of unemployment benefits. I just think that's a wrong-headed approach.
What about this idea that's been positioned out there, which I will not share my view on it because the interview is about you, not what I think, about we can't extend unemployment benefits, nor can we increase the amount of unemployment and benefits because folks won't want to go back to work. What does that say to you? What does that say to a black community, a white community, any community in the country that values work, that leaders think that if because they got an extra $600 in unemployment benefits, which may be more than their paycheck, oh, I'm just going to stay on unemployment.
Yes. I'm going to give up all the other benefits I may have.
Healthcare.
I'm going to do all that. Yeah. I'm going to choose to go on unemployment. First of all, it shows a fundamental lack of understanding of the unemployment system because you can't choose to go on unemployment. You have to be fired or laid off in order to receive unemployment benefits. Right. So you can't just say, oh, boss, you know what? I'm going to quit my job today so I can go on unemployment and get that $600 benefit. No, it doesn't work that way. So that's the first problem with it. The second problem with it is, you know, they started by targeting nurses and nursing assistants, people who are on the front lines right now of dealing with risking their lives on the coronavirus. And this is the example that Lindsey Graham gives in terms of, well, I don't want those nurses to quit. This is a thing I mentioned to the press. Lindsey needs to understand that nurses and nursing assistants also take an oath of office. They're an oath for their jobs.
Right.
Lindsey took an oath as well. Now, his oath may not mean a damn to him, but to a lot of other people, it actually does, because that's their livelihood. That's what they do. They go and they sacrifice their lives each and every day to try to save the lives of other people. And it's just sad for our senator. When you're already stressed, you're stressed because of the lives that you're seeing that are being lost, of you don't know what's going to happen in terms of your family, and you're already stressed. And then to have your United States senators, both of them, go up and beat up on you when you are at your lowest ebb. I mean, it's crazy. And so, and it's boneheaded. And, you know, if you get unemployment in South Carolina, the max you are going to get is $320. What kind of family can you raise on $320?
That was the point I raised in a tweet. It's like, you realize, of course, that you're the maximum benefit in South Carolina for unemployment is $320. So no matter what the increase is not going above $320. And I don't think anybody's going to quit their job for $320 a month or every 2 weeks or whatever it is. It's crazy. So Jamie, how would you then let's do a little role playing here. You're now the junior senator from South Carolina. We are witnessing or beginning to see a turnaround in the virus, meaning that we're about to see relapses. The country is about to go back through this again because it's winter, flu, cold and flu season. You're now in the United States Senate. How do you respond? What do you say or do different from what we've seen and heard so far or seen done so far?
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I hope by that time we actually have a czar or somebody who is, designated to really lead up this response so that they can coordinate efforts amongst the states, because right now that's just not happening. I mean, it would have made so much sense to have someone that is linked to FEMA, because FEMA understands how to deal with national disasters and right. responses. Now, sometimes they haven't done a great job, but, you know, of the folks that have some experience, you got some good people there. You have that type of czar to navigate so that you don't have states competing against each other in order to buy PPEs, right? So that you can orchestrate where you need to flow things. We haven't had that type of response. So if we haven't, I'm still encouraging that. Encouraging, I think Lindsay is right that a lot of the production that we need to do, we need to start doing it back in this country and not have it, because I think it's a national security issue for us to have other countries that are producing our medicines, our protective gear, and you can go down the road. I just think that's problematic to be reliant upon other nations in order to do that for our own nation. And it showed a glaring hole in our system, and we got to be able to address that. As it relates to the families, we need to make sure that we are working with these small businesses. The way that they've set the PPP program up does not work. The repayment plan for some of these small businesses is 2 years. Well, if you're a restaurant owner, you're already operating off of small margins. A two-year repayment plan for a loan, it just does not work. Mm-hmm. You're setting these folks up to fail. Extend that window out for 10 years, and because you know these people will be good for it. They want to pay their bills, but they also want to be able to survive so that they can provide those jobs that are so necessary and needed by folks.
So, Jamie, would that be a part of a package of things that you would advocate for in the Senate? I mean, what should the Senate be doing right now in terms of the actions it can take to lessen the economic impact? Because you have these competing interests that I think we have unfortunately misaligned, and that is the health versus the economy. And you know, from my perspective, you can recover from the economy. You can't recover from death. So it's just as simple as it is for me, particularly with respect to how we see 90 some thousand Americans now have lost their lives to this. So what kind of packages do you see that address this sort of these things that have been aligned to compete with each other, where maybe they shouldn't necessarily compete? They should find ways to complement each other.
I wholeheartedly agree with where you're going with this, because I've always said this. The greatest asset that we have as a nation is not our businesses. They're great, and they're a large part of what makes America special. But the thing that really makes us great, that really makes us special, are our people. And we got to invest in our people and not see them as, you know, something, we got to deal with, but the primary, because if they are healthy, if they are strong, we know we have some of the greatest people on the face of this globe. But there's certain things that we have to do. One of the things is healthcare. We are showing right now, this coronavirus is showing the big hole in healthcare right now. Something very simple is in the states that have not expanded Medicaid, even if they did it on a temporary basis for the next 2 or 3 years, expand Medicaid so we get those folks who don't have coverage covered so that those folks can go to the hospital. Because you know what? One of the things that I know is probably going on here in South Carolina, I remember how my grandfather was, guy who worked all the time, didn't want to go to the doctor because, one, he couldn't afford to. And so he would wait. He would take Robitussin. He drank hot toddies. He'd do all those types of things.
Y'all, now don't shortchange Robitussin. Because we get some tussin in you, you know, for everything. don't go shortchanging my Robitussin.
He would do all of those things just to avoid, because they were cheaper than going to the doctor where he had to pay out of pocket. And I know right now in South Carolina, there are probably people who have symptoms of the coronavirus, but they feel like they can try to come up with a remedy from home. And as a result, you know, they may continue to spread. They might still have to work. They still have to do all this and that. Let's just make sure that these working people have some health care coverage. There's ways that we can do that. Doug Jones has a bill right now that says to the Southern, that allows the Southern states that refuse to expand Medicaid to go to start anew, to start the clock over, to give them those first few years of 100% federal coverage, to allow that to happen. That's a no-brainer. Why don't we do that so that those folks have that peace of mind, and we can take those folks off and focus on the other folks who have no health care at all. I want to make sure, again, like I said, we are taking care of small businesses, our restaurants, because they are a huge part of the economy and our culture as a country. You know, to see some of these folks who've poured their whole lives, 20, 25 years into building up a restaurant, and to see it now go away over a course of the next few weeks, it is not only devastating to the economy, but it's devastating to the spirit of these communities that these organizations, these businesses were anchors for. So we need to make sure that we're doing things and we're building a system that helps to make sure that these folks are maintained for the long term. And that means also, you know, going up to the Ruth's Chris and all of these other billion-dollar businesses and saying, you don't need a PPP funding at this point in time. Not that we want to see you go under, but there's some much lower hanging fruit that we need to take care of, because if we don't, they will fall off the tree and they will rot and they will die. And we got to make sure that we're shoring those things up. And so, you know, there are a lot of great proposals out there. And, I mean, a lot of things that could bring more revenue into the economy, like rebuilding our infrastructure, putting broadband in rural communities, you know, and that could be great incentives for other parts of the economic of other economic sectors to really, you know, kick it up a notch and hire folks there. But we got to figure out how we offset the losses, but most importantly, how we protect the greatest asset that we have, which are our people.
One of my favorite comedians had a tour out last year, Tiffany Haddish, that was entitled "She Ready." Ladies and gentlemen, he ready. He ready.
Oh, thank you.
Jamie Harrison, candidate for the United States Senate from the great state of South Carolina. Thank you so much, man, for taking time to come on the Steel Podcast to lay out your story. And just for folks who are probably scratching their head, this was not an invitation for me to come and beat the hell out of Jamie because he's a Democrat and he may be wrong on the issues. No, this was a conversation about a brother coming on to talk about why it's important for people in his state to look at him and to give him a chance, and for people around the country to get to know who very well may be the next senator from the state of South Carolina. So I appreciate you, man. And I wish you the best. Good luck. And I did that debate on Meet the Press in 2006. It's a hell of a ride. Just do your homework. my boy Chuck Todd is no slouch.
I know.
Be ready, as they say.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. And for any of your listeners, you want to learn more, go to jamieharrison.com.
There it is. So with that, folks, we're gonna take a little break from this conversation. You know I'm going to be back because that's what I do. I love you guys very much and appreciate you. So stay safe, be well, be smart. Don't be crazy about having to go out and get that tattoo or that massage. You know, just put some ink on your hand and rub your fingers. There you go. That'll take care of both of those at home. You know where you can find us, of course, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcast on. Do that download thing, because when you do that, you make me feel oh so good. I appreciate you guys. Till next time, peace out.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.